Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock right now on this day, the 17th of December. Back in 1903, the Wright brothers would have their first sustained motorized aircraft flight take place on this day. In 1920, on this day, South Africa would receive from the League of Nations a mandate over Southwest Africa that would be modern day Namibia. It seems you could just issue mandates around things you wanted back then. In 2013, on this day, Angela Merkel would win her third term as Chancellor of Germany. And in 2017, on this day, famous Chinese painter Zhi Baixi would have his set of ink brush paintings auctioned off in Beijing for $140 million, setting a record for Chinese paintings at an auction. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we take a look at market developments. I thought markets would have gone quiet at this point. Apparently not. The Rand is down more than 1% against all of the major currencies. The top 40 is down more than 1%. The all shares down more than 1%. We're going to dig into those stories in a little bit with Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss. We're also going to take a look at the latest developments from TymeBank. They've concluded their Series D fundraising exercises, and they have raised some money from a very interesting partner in the form of Nubank in Brazil. Then we've got a conversation with Madiwa Gavaza, who is a tech analyst and a journalist, around the Telkom deal. It seems the regulatory approvals have finally gone ahead for Telkom to sell off that SwiftNet business. We're going to see what it means for Telkom. The share price did very little today, but we're going to dig into that and see if we can make sense of it. Then we're going to reflect on the year that was. We're going to go back to some of our most loved conversations throughout the year. And because Tuesdays would typically be Property Tuesdays or Agri Tuesdays, I thought we'd play both. We're going to play one of our best Agri conversations throughout the year and one of our best Property conversations throughout the year for you to reflect back on and remember.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we said, we're going to kick off with markets and how the markets have been moving. On a day where you'd think it would be a quiet day of movements, it wasn't. It was anything but that. I'm joined on the line by the portfolio manager and director of Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at this and see if we can understand what's been happening. Good evening, Gary. Lovely to catch up with you. The last week of effectively the trading year, particularly in South Africa's case, next week would be on the Christmas break. You'd think it would be a quiet day. It really wasn't.
Yeah, it really wasn't a quiet day. A lot of movement underneath. And I don't know if it is maybe a little bit of volume coming out of the market as well. And you tend to get those exaggerated price movements. But yeah, the all-share index finishing down just a touch below 1.6%. You know, the resource index leading us lower, that almost 2.5% down. Industrials also slipping throughout the day, finishing over 1% lower. And the financial index getting absolutely smashed, down 2%. And, you know, this was in line, you know, with some of the European markets. We had the DAX off slightly, you know, in Germany. The FTSE was also down about 0.66%. Yeah, Paris actually bucked the trend. They were up 0.25%, but S&P 500 and NASDAQ each down about 1/3 at the moment. So I think a little bit of jitters ahead of that Fed announcement tomorrow. You know, we've been chatting about it in our research meetings as well. You know, the idea that, you know, with Trump coming in, we might have, you know, inflationary policy coming through, and we might have Jerome Powell being a little bit more pessimistic and holding interest rates a little bit higher for longer than the market expected. And I think we're certainly seeing that in the yields at the moment. And yeah, the equity market also feeling a little bit of fear and selling off aggressively. You know, with the risk off trade, we've also seen that impacting the currency. So an absolutely massive move on the rand today, all on the rand dollar pair at least, from about 17.82 this morning out to 18.14 currently. That's a big move ahead of the end of the year. We all, obviously, those calendar year allowances will reset.
Mm. Gary, before we get into the Rand, I mean, the Fed conversation is quite an important one as well. I mean, we have been pricing in rate cuts. And I remember at the start of the year, what was it? 7? 6-7 rate cuts. You and I spoke about that. And then towards the end of the year, we were just hopeful to get one. So I guess it has really been a very interesting direction that the Fed has taken. And tomorrow being the last rate announcement, of course, markets might be, as you said, wanting to take a bit of risk off the table. But part of that could also be that the uncertainty that goes into 2025 is a new type of uncertainty. So we've dealt with all the different types of uncertainties, and now we're dealing with a second presidential term from a gentleman who, in his first presidential term, moved the markets on a social media platform.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, I think what interest rates and the Fed is always data dependent. They're always looking at the data. And if inflation didn't come out down as quickly as everyone hoped, of course, interest rates weren't going to come down that quickly either. So we did obviously see the front loading of first interest rate cuts. Markets got very excited about the 50 basis points that they got at the beginning. They've had another 25 basis points. And obviously we have the Fed meeting again tomorrow, and we'll get the decision tomorrow evening. And overwhelmingly, the expectation is that that there will be another 25 basis point cut. So Fed funds futures are pricing around a 95% chance that we're going to get a cut, about 5% chance that there's no cut. But if you look a little bit deeper out towards the January meeting, 19th of March meeting, the 7th of Feb meeting, you start to see a picture where this does look like we're going to get a cut and a pause and a cut and a pause. So that's where the market is thinking that the Fed is going to be a little bit more conservative until they see, as you say, what does the Trump administration do? What do what happens between the U.S.-China relations? You know, what kind of tariffs are going to go onto trading partners? You know, there's a lot of uncertainty around this new administration, and I mean, we understand that Donald Trump and is transactional. So I think a lot of this is posturing. I think it's going to be one of the key themes for 2025 is how much of the rhetoric is just rhetoric and almost a negotiating tactic, and how much translates into real, you know, punitive tariffs and big regulatory changes that can be made by the executives. So I think that is going to be a key theme next year. But it's not just the Trump administration. We have a couple of other things that also at play at the moment. I mean, obviously, we've got the geopolitical space. You've got, obviously, conflicts in the Middle East at the moment, conflicts in Eastern Europe as well. Any real escalation of those could result in supply chain disruptions. That could easily be inflationary. You'll remember when the Russia-Ukraine war broke out originally, and just the disruption that we saw in the soft commodity space and how that impacts inflation numbers. That could be independent of America's interference in Eastern Europe, and that really still is a significant risk for markets, I think, going into 2025, and could enhance increase inflation and obviously put a bit of a dampener on the lower rate environment everyone's hoping for.
Speaking of risks going into 2025, Gary, what else are you kind of seeing? I mean, obviously those geopolitical risks, some of them have been with us for quite a number of months up to now, so it's not really something that we think might be new going into next year. But what are some of the risks that you're seeing from an asset management point of view and saying, hang on, this could still play out? I mean, chief among those risks, as I sit here thinking of it, has to be Donald Trump. He in himself is a risk, and we've touched on that now in the way in which he can affect the market. But what else are you looking out for next year?
Yeah, I think the two of the big ones are, of course, three, as you say, Trump administration, geopolitical risks, the trajectory of inflation and interest rates is absolutely key. But maybe an additional risk as well is just the valuations as well. Some of the valuations, specifically on the offshore companies, are looking a little bit stretched. If you look at the S&P 500 in aggregate, just in terms of earnings, we are expecting a lot from U.S. companies at the moment, and we're kind of trending towards the upper range of just valuations if you look in price earnings terms. So markets are a little bit expensive. I think a lot has been priced into the interest rate cuts, and if that doesn't materialize, I think you might get a correction. Even though you don't get a correction necessarily in the earnings of these companies, you might see a little bit of a price correction as well, and I do think that's a risk. And I think, you know, from a portfolio management point of view and from a, as you say, an asset management point of view, I follow a very blended approach. Obviously it depends on the portfolio that we're building, but I think having a little bit of value, looking for that, not just gearing yourself entirely towards growth at this stage, it could protect you next year. And certainly there are some companies that have pretty spectacular growth track records, but are not looking particularly expensive. But if you look at that kind of Mag 7 basket, you do see some pretty crazy valuations at the moment.
I was just coming to that, Gary, to say, are you saying that we need to be wary of the Mag 7 valuations? Because that would be a first. I mean, for the longest time throughout this year, every single time the Mag 7 has come up in conversation, the rhetoric has been exactly the same. The Mag 7 is carrying everybody, let them do their own thing, and it is what it is. But now we're finally getting to a point where potentially we could be questioning how much further the valuations can stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think the Magnificent Seven as a group, yes, they are the mega cap segment of the market. They're absolutely enormous, but they are very, very different companies. So, we look at something like Nvidia as part of that group, and a lot of people, that we chat to, oh, but Nvidia's in a bubble, it can't continue like this, and they kind of equate it to the tulip mania and that. But the fact is, Nvidia, these are real sales that Nvidia is making. They are selling, they might have a fairly concentrated client base, but they are selling these chips, and these are real revenue numbers that are coming in for the firm. So if you think about it in the context of tulip mania, they're selling tulips at this stage, which is a pretty good place to be. at the same time, you look at something like Tesla as it moves into kind of full self-driving. You look at, I suppose, the political positioning of Elon Musk at the moment, and it's difficult not to back that. But looking at a company like Apple, I'm a little bit more circumspect around something like Apple at the moment. I think we need to see real innovation coming out of Apple if you compare it as part of the basket. But yeah, as I said, if you go back to the valuations, these companies have pretty high expectations set on what they're going to do quarter by quarter, and they need to match them. Otherwise, you can easily see an unwind in the share price without necessarily a significant unwind in the underlying earnings figures.
Mm. Gary, when we're looking at valuations, I want to get your thoughts quickly on China valuations. Those have been on the receiving end of some serious negativity, and whether or not that negativity is warranted is another story, especially with the Chinese stimulus and how that disappointing that's been and all of that. Where do you see Chinese valuations going into the new year? Obviously, understanding that part of it might be dependent on what China says themselves.
Now, it's interesting that you say that the Chinese stimulus has been disappointing, because I also get the sense that every time the Chinese authorities, every time Beijing stimulates, we all kind of go, oh, well, that wasn't enough. We were hoping for more. And we look at the market reaction to the stimulus and feel a little bit disappointed. But if you look at, when you look at the way that China stimulates the economy, they don't often give, quantitative numbers. It's really you've got to look at the messaging that's coming out of Beijing. And, for the longest time, their monetary policy has kind of been prudent. And prudent has been the way that they've described their monetary policy. They've now moved towards moderately loose monetary policy. And the last time this term was used in the Chinese context was the global financial crisis. So the stimulus measures that we're expecting from China are going to be very, very big. And yet the market is not, you feel the market has not been disappointed, it has been disappointed. Yet if we actually look at what has happened to, let's say, I always look at the FXI, which is the iShares China large cap ETF. If I look at that year to date, and I rebase it to US dollars, you look at it, the total return for that instrument is around 34% in US dollars. If you compare that to the NASDAQ, which has been one of the clearly best performing markets, that's up around 31% in US dollars at the moment. So China actually outperforming the NASDAQ year to date in 2024. S&P 500, that's up around 29.5%. MSCI World up about 22%. The JSE coming in at around 21.5%, which is pretty spectacular. Below that, you're going to find Germany, the Euro stocks, Australia, France. So Europe really underperforming. But China, with these stimulus measures and with their focus on equity markets, really has started to get it right, certainly in their large cap stocks. So if you go back to the valuations question, if you look at something like Alibaba compared to a US-listed counterpart, I mean, there's no question. These things are absolutely dirt cheap at the moment. And it really is that regulatory overhang and I suppose the opaque nature of Chinese securities that scares investors and makes them look at them and go, wait a minute, that's, you know, I need to apply significant discount based on let's say regulatory risk, for example. So there's no question China is really, really cheap. Now China has problems. Obviously there's demographic issues. I think the whole Chinese economy is also changing. The idea that you've always been a very infrastructure-led economy. It's moving more towards a service-driven economy as well. We are now expecting, Chinese-US tensions to escalate as Donald Trump comes in on the 20th of January. So there are still a lot of risk factors around China. But if you just look at market pricing for 2024, it's actually been a great place to invest. So yeah, with that, it again comes down to valuations. If you buy something at a price that's reasonable enough, there will probably be upside.
Maybe we should stop putting so much pressure on China. Maybe that's our own fault. It's our fault for saying to China they should constantly outperform everybody else. And that's probably why we're disappointed by these stimulus packages. But we will leave the conversation there, Gary. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights. Thank you for your contributions throughout the year. I trust you and I will be speaking early into the new year as we look ahead to 2025. But for now, we'll leave the conversation there. Gary Boysen, Portfolio Manager and Director at Rand Swiss, on the market movements today, some of the risks going into the new year, and how markets might be seeing some of these tensions.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Last week, TymeBank officially closed their investment round. They were raising some funds for their expansionary plans and their growth plans. And as part of that, we got confirmation that they got on board a very interesting investor in the form of Nubank, based out in Brazil. This is one of the largest fintech companies that we have at the moment, servicing more than 110 million clients around the world. And they have invested into TymeBank. I'm joined on the line by the TymeBank CEO, Carl Westvik, to take a look at these developments and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Carl. Lovely to catch up with you, especially at this time of the year. Very good time to be closing up this kind of deal, wrapping things up on a high at the end of 2024.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's actually quite a momentous day for all of us announcing the deal, and we'll spend time talking about Nubank and the opportunities, but it's incredible.
Carl, before we get to Nubank, let's get through the rest of the investment raise and the exercise that was around that. Obviously, going out to the capital markets, going out to different funders and saying, well, these are the plans that we have for TymeBank. It's been quite a journey, and we've been keeping up with bits and pieces of that journey as you've been going through. Take us through where we stand now from a TymeBank perspective. You've just closed the investment round. What was raised? What's been committed? What's going on?
So this is what we call in fundraising terms a Series D. So basically it's the fourth large round we're raising. We've raised $250 million. So in Rand terms, that's sort of 4.5 billion Rand, which is a substantial amount. And that's largely aimed at growing out our new territories with some support for South Africa. So South Africa, as TymeBank, we now are break even and profitable, which means we don't require significant working capital, but just support in terms of growing our asset base. Philippines is probably 12, 18 months away from getting to break even, so they require some capital. And then we have plans to get into Vietnam and into Indonesia, and that's what this round will be for.
Now, Carl, when we look at the expansionary plans, I mean, having a digital bank obviously gives you a bit more flexibility than the traditional banking environment in that it allows you to expand into these sorts of territories quicker and in a more nimble fashion. Take me through the growth strategy from the business's perspective around what types of products you're looking at, what types of servicing. I mean, TymeBank as a business has already clocked its first 10 million clients. It's been growing at a very, very good, solid rate. What What are you looking to do now? Are you looking to expand geographically, like you said, into Vietnam and Indonesia? Or are you looking to also now add potentially new products as well?
So both are true. But so let me talk about the business model. So being a digital bank, we don't generally have physical infrastructure on the ground. So we don't have to build branches. So it is much quicker to enter a market. We typically are entering on the back of retailers and retail sites. So we drop a kiosk into a store, and that effectively becomes the face of the bank, where customers can onboard through a kiosk or onboard through an app on a phone. So it's much lower touch and lower cost to acquire. So part of the investment is to grow out our product set, and that's expanding into the likes of credit cards, more buy now, pay later. As we go into new territories, so in Philippines, we almost have a full service offering. Vietnam, we're leading with the Merchant Cash Advance product, which stems from the old retail capital business that was acquired by TymeBank. And likewise, we'll probably lead in Indonesia as well with a lending product, and then follow that shortly afterwards with a fully fledged bank, either with our own license or with a banking partner.
Carl, let's look at this new bank deal, or at least the new bank commitments, from an investment point of view. Obviously, having someone that has that size of market share and that size of presence in the digital landscape coming through and saying we are going to invest into TymeBank is not only a show of confidence, but it also gives you guys some strategic advantages going forward to say there's some areas we might be able to leverage off of this strategic partner. Take us through how that relationship is shaping up.
So let me spend a bit of time on Nubank, because I think people don't realize the scale of that organization. So they're only about 11 years old as an organization, but 110 million customers, they make over $500 million a quarter in profits already. So they're a significant player. We met the team from Nubank, and the one thing I can say is they're incredibly focused and incredibly great at executing. So they are experts in customer experience, customer service. So they have what they call a net promoter score. So what percentage of customers would promote them to other people, of over 90%, where we typically in South Africa are sitting at 55 to 60%. So we have a lot to learn in terms of making a better and better offering, for one. Secondly, they are experts in lending. So they've built very deep expertise in credit cards and personal lending. So that's something we could leverage in South Africa. So there's definitely going to be a level of advisory and IP support that's going to come from Nubank in the transaction, along with the $150 million they're investing in the group.
Carl, when we look at the digital landscape, there's obviously so much developing from a digital standpoint. Is TymeBank looking at things around blockchain, crypto, that sort of thing? I mean, we're seeing very clearly that this is becoming something that's growing in popularity, with the likes of Microsoft even saying they're potentially considering, or they wanted to look at putting things like Bitcoin on their balance sheet. From a digital product perspective, and even from a digital offering perspective, are you guys looking at experimenting with new things, or are you saying there's enough of the traditional market out there at the moment for us to capitalize on that?
Jimmy, we're always innovating. So we looked a number of years back at the start of time of launching a cryptocurrency. At that stage, the market wasn't quite ready, and the regulatory environment wasn't ready for it. So, but certainly a lot of work's been done in that space, and we have some experts in the bank. From a group perspective, we're considering all of these options: crypto, remittances, credit cards, as I said, and then also overlaying that with being AI-led in many respects.
Carl, what do the prospects look like for the bank going into 2025? I know it might be a little too soon to discuss whether or not we're going to have a listing or an IPO date, but I imagine that is not too far in the distant future.
So we publicly come out to say that, you know, our intention is to be IPO ready by 2028. So it gives us the next 3 or 4 years to invest in the right technology, get scale and profitability in certain markets. And the intention is to do a primary listing on New York Stock Exchange and a secondary listing in JSE. That's our plans at the moment. And we think the New York Stock Exchange understands the asset class. So, you know, as a digital bank, Nubank have been well received. They have a very large market capitalization already on the New York Stock Exchange. So that gives us a good platform to leverage in a couple of years' time.
And that market cap from Nubank has grown by more than 50% in this year alone. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note, Carl. We wish you guys the best of luck. Congratulations on wrapping up a Series D investment rounds. Here's to great execution and moving the business forward. That's Carl Westvig, who is the CEO at Time Bank, joining me to take a look at their wrapping up of their latest investment round and what it means for the business going forward.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, this deal's been on the table for 3 odd years or so. It was on the table, it was off the table, it was back on the table. It needed regulatory approvals, and it's finally gotten over the regulatory hurdles. ICASA, the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, has approved the sale of Telkom's mast and towers business, SwiftNet, in that 6.75 billion rand deal. Joined on the line by tech analyst and journalist at Business Day, Mudiwa Kavaza, to take a look at this and see if we can wrap our heads around the deal. Good evening, Mudiwa. Lovely to catch up with you as always. The last time you and I spoke about this deal, we were having coffee and we discussed whether or not this deal was actually going to ever get off the ground. There was different conversations around it, whether or not the buyer was ready, whether or not it was going to be approved. It looks like we're finally moving ahead.
Yeah, we're finally moving ahead, and you know, finally Telkom will be able to take this particular business off of its balance sheet. They've been working on this deal for the better part of, I'm going to call it, 5 or so years now. As you said earlier on, the deal was on the table, off the table, but finally they were able to make something happen, albeit at a much, much reduced rate, to where this particular discussion began.
Mm. Mudiwa, what does this then mean, obviously, for the Telkom business? You get rid of 4,000 towers and masts under the SwiftNet business. You make some money. What do you do then?
So there's a couple of things, that are at play here. The first one is the fact that, well, firstly, we have to recognize that the market is in a different place to what it was back in 2019 when Telkom under Sipho Maseko first made the intentions to sell this business known. At that time, you know, according to their valuation model, they were looking at around a 13 billion rand valuation around this particular business. At that time, for those that follow Telkom, they will know that around that time, Telkom had suspended dividends. They had taken on a lot of debt, to push some of their, infrastructure and capital investment. So it was thought that this deal would help to pay back, a lot of that debt and, put a little bit more cash, into their kitty. And the same rationale still exists now. And like I said, it's at a much reduced rate. When they first floated the idea, when they first wanted to go to the market, you had the 13 billion rand valuation, then it went down to 10. We understood that it went down to below 10, and then they ended up at the 6.75 that we're talking about today. And the thinking is that the money is going to go mainly towards, paying off some of the debt. We recently spoke to Serame, who's their CEO. He's quite happy with where the group's gearing is at the moment because they've sort of gone down. I think they were above, 1.8, times, but now I think they're closer to 1.2, 1.3 times. And, they'll probably be able to edge that, even lower given this. And then I think the other piece is also just investing in, that CapEx, capital expenditure specifically, increasing their mobile network in areas that have demand and increasing connectivity on fiber in areas where they have demand as well.
Mudiwa, the business obviously has to make certain tough decisions around how they navigate the space now, understanding, of course, that their plans might look very different from what they originally envisioned, and we probably won't get the 13 billion rand valuation that we thought we might get for their business. When you are Telkom, what's left of the business after the fact?
After the fact, you are left with three main businesses. That is Telkom, what they call Telkom Consumer, which is basically Telkom Mobile. And then you're left with BCX, which is the systems integrator business. And then you're left with OpenServe, which is the fiber business. Back in the day, you had more or less five main businesses inside of Telkom a couple of years ago. And the other two units included SwiftNet, which is now which is what we're talking about today. But in addition, there was another business called Gyro, which was their properties business, and they've actually been selling off a lot of those properties. So right now, what you're left with is a mobile business, a fiber infrastructure business, and a systems integrator business. And according to the company's rationale, all of their offerings are going to be underpinned by the fiber infrastructure because they are the biggest fiber network operator in the country, and they're trying to see how they can compete, and outcompete their rivals, given that place in the market. So you get into business, you've got a mobile business that is underpinned by that fiber, because a lot of the capital expenditure that you see being done by Vodacom and MTN, for example, is with what's called fiber backhaul, which is basically connecting your different tower infrastructure to your core network. But because Telkom has had this investment done already, they end up spending less. So their rate of CapEx is actually at a lower rate than the others. And if Serame is to be believed, they're also carrying more data and being more efficient about how they're allocating their CapEx right now.
Muriwa, in the telecom space, you and I have had this debate around kind of how to position your business, right? So, do you position yourself as a technology provider, an infrastructure provider? I mean, the reason you're getting rid of SwiftNet is because you don't necessarily want that kind of infrastructure to maintain and all of that on your balance sheet. It can sit on someone else's balance sheet, but you can still make use of it. We've seen other telcos go the MVNO route and say, we don't want any infrastructure, we'll use other people's infrastructure. How do we bring down fiber costs, understanding that someone like OpenServe and Telkom are effectively well within a good positioning from their infrastructure and their networks to be able to do that, to sustainably bring down the costs of these things? And when you do that as a business, how do you do it but keep a profit?
You know, Jimmy, what you're talking about is very key, and I think it's probably the thing that's keeping up, Serame and his team, at night the most, is that understanding what Telkom is in the marketplace is a little bit hard. Do you judge them along typical, fixed line operator, sort of metrics, when the tide has turned and that business is now, that legacy business is now, about 20% of the of what it used to of the business now? Do you judge them as a fiber network operator? Do you judge them as a mobile operator because they've got the fastest growing mobile business in the country? Do you judge them as a systems integrator because of BCX? And that's probably, from an investor point of view, that's probably the biggest conundrum Telkom faces, because when you are an analyst judging MTN or judging Vodacom, you are more or less judging them along mobile lines. Yes, they're trying to grow all of these other areas of business, such as fintech. You've got Vodacom trying to be a bigger player in fiber. Look at what they're trying to do with Remgro and Maziv. But at the core of it, they get judged as mobile operators. Whereas with Telkom, they are a mobile operator, but they also have all of this other stuff, which makes up a significant portion of their business. So, in my view, I think they need to probably do a lot more work in educating the market about what their business is about, what's driving revenues, what's driving profitability. The efficiencies that we're talking about just now, where you underpin your mobile, you underpin your infrastructure, and you underpin your service, your systems integrator business with fiber that's already been put down in the ground, all of that needs to be a little bit more clear. Because if you judge them along mobile operator lines, then they look like they're lagging behind. If you judge them just on one of the other two, then they look like they are lagging behind on profit metrics, on CapEx spend, all of that. So I think they probably need to find a way to communicate that better. And on the other side of that table, there'll probably need to be a blended approach that analysts will have to take when it comes to judging Telkom and what it is. Because on the one end, your BCX is competing with an Altron, with an EOH, with those types of businesses. Telkom Mobile is competing with MTN and Vodacom, and then your fiber business is competing against the likes of Vumatel and Metro Fiber and the like. So a blended approach, in my view, is probably going to have to be the way forward. Whether or not the market players take it that way, I'm not sure. You can educate me because you tend to sit and analyze these things. How would you do that?
Well, I for one, I mean, we've addressed a lot of issues, and I for one want to still look at the fact that they are still partly an SOE. We haven't even touched on that,
Yes,
right? So
yes.
you've got all of these different infrastructure things that you want to be doing, and it's a clear example of where you need to trim down so that you're a leaner business. You can navigate the waters better. You can't be a jack of all trades in this respect when the market is that big. You pick an area of specialization, perhaps if there is more than one area that you are exceptionally good at, that would be great. But the last thing you want here is an SOE that goes backwards after digging its out of a hole and suddenly goes back to not being profitable because you spread yourself too thin. And that's a conversation that would probably need to be had with Telkom to understand what it is that they're going to do. But as we wrap up our conversation, Madiwa, looking at the deal, the regulatory things have gone through, the balance sheet is supposedly going to get lighter, the share price didn't move at all. The share price was, it opened around the 30 Rand range. In fact, it opened around, I think it was 34 Rand. If I look at it for the daily movements today, it's done less than 0.5% of movements. So is that markets being a little thin and dried out over the holiday period, or is it just markets saying we already knew that this was in the works? It's not new information.
I think it's probably the latter. To say that the market has probably just pr had already priced this action into what you call this, they had already priced this action into their models already, because before this, they had already received shareholder approval back in May, for the deal, and then in September, the Competition Tribunal also gave the deal a green light. So our market players already had, a chance to react to this. However, what I would say when it comes to Telkom's share price specifically is that the asterisk I would put on it is to say that despite a lack of movement today, they've probably been the telecoms operator that has performed the best in the market through 2024, because MTN, if we look at a year to date, from a year to date point of view, they are trading in negative territory. And then if you look at Vodacom, they've more or less been trading, up or down within a 1 to 2% range, where they're either positive 1% or negative 1 to 2%. So, hardly a lot of change there. Whereas Telkom is up 17%, through the year. So, somewhere in the market, people are at least appreciating the moves that they're making.
Absolutely. And a bulk of that gain from a Telkom perspective came through in the month of November, where they did about 25% there. So clearly the market loving the news that we got. I think it was around the time we got some numbers from Telkom as well, and the market really responsive to that. It's been a while since the share price has been above 30 Rand, honestly, and we're happy to see it there. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Mudiwa. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights as always. Mudiwa Gavaza joining me to take a look at the Telkom deal, finally getting the regulatory approvals from ICASA to go ahead for them to sell off that SwiftNet business.
My name is Sipho Mwanza, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Mezza Wines, which offers tokenized wine investments, which are not correlated to traditional financial markets and is becoming a popular alternative investment. Be sure to join me and Kieran Ryan on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast this week, where I will explain how tokenized wine investment works.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb. your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And of course, it's Tuesday, which means it's either Property Tuesday or Agri Tuesday. And we're on Property Tuesday this week, and we're taking a look at a very interesting concept that I'm sure all of you are familiar with, and that is around multi-generational living. In some way, shape, or form, this has touched your life or affected your life. And we're going to look at that because that seems to be on the rise for a number of reasons. Obviously, the fact that interest rates are where they are don't make it any easier, right? And to help me with this conversation, I'm joined on the line by the Managing Director of Only Realty Property Group, that's Grant Smear, to take a look at this. Good evening, Grant. Thanks for the time. Let's start by looking at this concept and unpacking the concept. For some people, this is not a new thing. I mean, having your parents live with you, having your children live with you, that's not a foreign concept for many of us. But the growing trend has emerged that this is becoming more and more of a situation. What's happening here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, multi-generational household is essentially two sets of adult families living under the same roof. And that's really driven by a few things, which aren't unique to South Africa, but obviously are playing a part. You mentioned high interest rates, the high cost of living, you know, the high cost of home ownership also adds to those, the reasons why there are more and more multi-generational homes.
Now, you mentioned a couple of these factors, Grant, and obviously the cost of ownership is such a big one where it comes to homes, because homes aren't necessarily the cheapest or the quickest things to buy and pay off. But when we look at the home setup, are we seeing a trend in the types of homes that are being preferred for multi-generational living?
Yes, I mean, you know, multi-generational living seems to be focused on the freehold homes, so larger properties where you're able to either split a existing home into sections, which are defined sections to live in, or spaces that have granny flats or outdoor space that can be converted, garages, for example, or outside storage spaces that can be converted into livable spaces.
So a weird thing that happens with this, Grant, is there's also this kind of multi-generational thing where, yes, we could do it in one home, but for some people, it also stretches beyond one home. So you find yourself contributing towards more than one household, and that might be because of the circumstances or whatever. Are we seeing that people are starting to change from that pattern and saying, okay, I'm currently contributing towards one, two, three households, let me consolidate it into one? Or is it people are still saying, we look at it from a first-time home buying perspective, a newlywed couple? What are the dynamics that are driving some of these decisions that consumers are making?
Yes, I think, you know, a multi-generational living not only comes down to the cost of living, but its ability to afford a new property. So you mentioned newly married couples. They may move in with one or other parent to sit and save money together, contribute towards the cost of the home that they're living in, so it's cheap for the parent, but also enables them to save and create a space for them to eventually put down a deposit and buy their own property. You know, there's similarly cases where you would have a multi-generational home to look after your elderly parents, as an example, and take care of them and have them nearby, or in fact for your parents to provide support to you as you you know, maybe the couple both parents are working and they need somebody to help with the kids. So there's so many scenarios where multi-generational living really do help, not only in cost saving, but in family support and infrastructure around your lifestyle, as well as, you know, if you, for example, sick, or if you have younger kids.
Now, these are very good advantages and very good strategic advantages for multi-generational living. But how do you get it right, Grant? What are some of the pitfalls you need to be aware of, and how do you set up a structure where everybody still kind of has their own independence, their own little space, and especially when you don't have the budget to buy a farm-sized property and renovate the whole property. How do you get it right to have this multi-generational setup without everybody feeling a little claustrophobic?
Yeah, so I think that's a vitally important point. Is, you know, if you want to make multi-generational living successful in your space and sort of live through several years of living as a group of adults, you know, there's a few things you need to do. You need to establish clear boundaries and expectations across all parties that are living together. You know, make sure that you designate personal space, and that could either be separate buildings or separate parts of the home or property. And then I think communication is key, and compromising on certain aspects of your lifestyle. I mean, you're doing so because you are saving money, or there are certain advantages that you see living together as in a multi-generational property.
Grant, when we look at property itself in the context of multi-generational, are people able to sort of build these kinds of setups within a complex? Because, I mean, security still becomes a factor here. And as you rightly mentioned, there are advantages to having people at home or having that sense of support within the home. But you also want to ensure that everybody's protected when you're not there.
Yeah, so I think, you know, although we see it far less in sectional type properties, it's certainly possible. We do see it in sort of young professionals gathering together, two young couples getting together and renting out a two-bedroom property in a sectional type complex. So it is certainly possible in sectional type complexes to do so. That provides security, a sense of community, as well as maybe cheaper options in terms of a sort of multi-generational space. So although it's less common, it certainly is a possibility, and it does work out. Although if you are intending or moving walls or breaking walls or creating a space and building a space around you, which is multi-generational, then you do need to look at freestanding homes and go through the process that is required for making those alterations.
So you have more flexibility with the freestanding homes to make those necessary adjustments, but you also have the option to take up additional security and manage that process. That's quite an interesting concept, and I think a lot more families seem to be heading in this direction with, as we said, where things are in terms of costing and just from a comfort perspective. We'll leave it at that, Grant. Thanks so much for those insights. Grant Smear, who is Managing Director at the Only Realty Property Group, joining me to reflect on multi-generational living.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That was one of our best property conversations that we've had throughout the year. And as I said, we're going to continue reflecting on these conversations. We've also lined up one of our favorite agri segments throughout the year. And here it is. It's Tuesday, it's Agri Tuesday this week, and we're taking a look at a very interesting concern in the agricultural space, the halting of anti-venom production that has raised some serious concerns in the animal kingdom, I suppose. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of the African Snake Bite Institute, Johan Moret, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Good evening, Johan. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding the particular anti-venom that has been halted in terms of production and its uses in everyday life in South Africa.
Thank you for the invite. It hasn't really halted. It just seems that the wheels have come off. So antivenom in South Africa, we have two regular snake antivenoms. We have a monovalent boomslang antivenom, and then we have a polyvalent antivenom that covers the venom of 10 snakes, most of the cobras, the adders, the runcals. And it is produced by the South African vaccine producers, which is part of the National Health Laboratories. And since COVID, there's been a dire shortage, and it appears at this stage that there is virtually no production and virtually no stock. Very difficult for us to get answers, but I have seen recent emails where they have said that they do not have stock. Now, the problem with the anti-venom is that in a serious snake bite, it is the correct treatment for a human and for pet, especially dogs that get bitten very often because they're natural hunters. They see a snake and they want to kill it. And the veterinarians are finding it extremely difficult to obtain anti-venom, and a lot of dogs are dying.
Johan, when we look at the production of the anti-venom, is there a missing ingredient that's perhaps caused the production to slow down? What is the process like to manufacture the anti-venom, and do we kind of know where the holdup is?
No, we're not sure where the holdup is. There has been excuses in the past. It's a long process. You basically
take the venom of the 10 snakes and you inject it into a horse in very small quantities, just enough to trigger its immune system, not enough to harm the horse in any way. And week by week, you increase these dosages, and it takes the horse about 9 months to become immune to the snake venom. At that stage, you can draw about 9 liters of blood every second month, and the serum is removed from the blood, purified, and that pretty much is the anti-venom. So you're injecting patients with horse serum, and that horse serum finds the venom and neutralizes it. So if you have any problems in that 9-month process, you're going to have to start from scratch.
That sounds like a very complicated process. Johan, when we think about the number of people that are bitten by snakes, or the number of humans and pets, I suppose, that are bitten by snakes either every year or every month, how serious a problem does this become if we continue to not have anti-venom on the ready or on hand?
Yes, it's a disaster. You know, humans, we have about 10 to 12 snake bite fatalities a year. And in most of these cases, if you can hospitalize the patient very early on, soon after the bite, and provide the correct treatment, you can save a lot of lives. But that gives us no indication of the morbidity, because 9 out of 10 bites that we see are from snakes with cytotoxic venom that do tissue damage. And in a lot of these cases, the tissue damage is severe. And that means that you're going to have a patient in a hospital for months, various operations, disfigurement, potentially amputations. And by and large, in South Africa, as in many other African countries, snake bite is a poor man's disease. If you're a rural farmer working barefoot in the field, you're exposed. Your risk of a bite is infinitely higher. And more often than not, you're very far away from the nearest hospital. That's the one part of the problem. Far more dogs get bitten by snakes, because snakes end up in suburban gardens. The dogs tackle them. And these are people's pets. And they end up at a vet, and the vet does not have anti-venom. And in any serious bite, there's a likelihood that that dog will die.
Johan, is there an alternative solution here? Something like importing the venom in the meantime? Is that even an option? I mean, the process you outlined earlier on around how the venom is manufactured seems very complicated and quite lengthy. And as you said, any disruptions to that cause a greater problem than having to just get that. Can we get the venom elsewhere?
Yes, there is a solution. There is a product called Pan-African Premium that comes in from India. It has World Health Organization approval. It's distributed in South Africa. But because it's not a registered drug here, you have to apply to purchase it under Section 21 of SAHPRA, which means that you have to do a fair amount of paperwork to be able to access this antivenom. The second problem is that it costs per vial about the same as the local antivenom, just over 2,000 rand a vial. So in humans with polyvalent antivenom, you're going to need 6 vials for a start. With a Pan-African problem, you need double the dosage. So you're looking at double the cost. So for a mama bite, for instance, you'll start with, let's say, 12 vials. You're looking at about close on 30,000 rand. But with a Pan-African product, you're looking at about 60,000 rand just for the antivenom and not for the treatment.
Johan, as the African Snakebite Institute, your role, I mean, obviously, aside from keeping South Africans, consumers and citizens informed around these things, is also the protection of whether it's snake species or human species alike. Is there kind of a way that individuals can safeguard themselves? Are there immediate dangers in that respect, or are we kind of still safe at the moment?
Yes, we're safe at the moment. The major hospitals do have stock. Some of the private hospitals have started stocking the imported product. But I think it's important for people to take basic precautions. Snakes bite in desperation. When you stand on them, or when you accidentally corner them, if you try and kill them, that's when they bite. So our recommendation is that, especially at night, people should try and use torches. A lot of people get bitten when they accidentally stand on snakes. As for snakes in gardens, they're attracted by rodents and they're attracted by frogs. So if you have water features, you can attract the frogs. If you have dog food lying around, bird aviaries with seeds around, you attract the rodents, and that brings the snakes in. So keep your property clean. And the moment you see an abundance of rodents, which most people don't see because they're sitting watching television or doing whatever they do indoors and they don't know what's going on outdoors, but keep an eye out for that. You have rodents around, you're going to attract snakes.
Certainly some very interesting insights and things to be aware of, especially when you take your next trip around your garden. We'll leave it at that, Johan. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights, and especially for the alert. That's Johan Marais, who is the CEO of the African Snakebite Institute, on the shortage of anti-venom that is currently in the market and how you can stay safe. And with that, we've come to the end of our show. We'll continue reflecting on our conversations from throughout the year as we wrap up the rest of this week. But for right now, it's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hose is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.